Previously on Robbery, Inc., he was handsome, cunning, and brazen. A compulsory thief and a chronic escape artist, there was no bank or prison MLJ wouldn't dare try to break in or out of. And to make matters worse, he had a wicked sense of humor.
Congratulations, Neo, you're the first banker in Cobb held up with a shovel.
Could it be that someone who uses a box at the Cobb Exchange Bank hasn't found out yet what happened to its contents?
Harold Willingham was another character.
We know who robs the Cobb Exchange Bank. We know how they did it. We know how much they stole. There's only one thing left to do. We've got to find Morris Lynn Johnson. In April 1974, a group of thieves tunneled beneath Roswell Street in Marietta, Georgia, and blasted their way into the Cobb Exchange Bank vault, only to be mocked for escaping with just $1,000. But as investigators dug deeper, they uncovered a far bigger mystery, and the story of a career bank robber whose daring heists and prison escapes made him a legend. This is Robbery, Inc., from Georgia Public Broadcasting and the Marietta Daily Journal. Family. For some, it's what life is worth living for. For others, it's a liability. But for Morris Lynn and Leon Johnson, blood made you thick as thieves. Between robbing banks, breaking out of prisons, running from the law, and serving as each other's alibis, it seemed as if there wasn't anything the Johnson brothers didn't do together. It added another layer of dirt to dig up in our investigation. What was it like to have a brother who would lie under oath for you, stick up a bank for you, shoot at the law for you? Maybe, if I found one brother, I could find the other. My name is Madison Elizabeth Hogan. You're listening to Robbery, Inc., Episode 6, The Family Business. When we began our journey together, I told you I was drawn to this story because I grew up in Marietta. I traveled over Roswell Street countless times in my life, unknowingly passing a piece of local history each time. I first heard about the Cobb Exchange burglary in 2021 from J.K. Murphy, the VP of content at the Marietta Daily Journal, while I was serving as the paper's lifestyle and magazine editor. J.K. shared with me the Mission Impossible crime, the rumors, the mystery shrouding the unknown assailants. At the time, we had no idea who committed the burglary when I first began my investigation. But just like you, the minute I heard about it, I was hooked. When I discovered MLJ's identity, I went deeper and deeper into that tunnel. Much like our bandits, I found myself digging day after day into the early morning hours, searching for treasure. Each time I would unearth more and more clues, and the search became an obsession. I knew this story like the back of my hand. Something about MLJ resonated with me, a kinship, if you will, because I have an Indiana outlaw in my family too. MLJ was sentenced in New Albany, Indiana in 1963 for the robbery of the Merchants National Bank and Trust Co. in Indianapolis. When I read this in the newspaper archives, I laughed out loud. While MLJ was facing the music in court, my grandparents were living in the neighboring town, Jeffersonville, Indiana, going about their lives. My father was born just 9 months later. And nearly 70 years prior, my own relative was in a similar legal pickle. In the late 1800s, Harrison Hogan was facing countless criminal charges in Jefferson County, Indiana. Dubbed the Terror of Bull Creek, he was known for his 8 marriages, shootouts with law enforcement, large stature, calming appearance, and public support. We'd need a whole other podcast to hash out his criminal dealings. But to summarize, his biggest stunt happened in his late 70s when he held off a siege from the local sheriff for more than 2 months in a makeshift shanty on the Ohio River. Coincidentally, my parents named my younger brother Harrison Hogan, completely unaware of the tales of the Bull Creek Terror. My mom was a Harrison Ford fan. Needless to say, I found this to be a strange coincidence, and I was even more determined to find MLJ. In episode 4, part 2, the last we heard of our man in question, he was on the lam again, sending holiday postcards to judges and FBI agents as a humorous farewell in 1976. But before he could ride off in the proverbial sunset like a Clint Eastwood character, MLJ was captured a year later by FBI agents in Burnsville, Minneapolis. He was found with an exotic dancer girlfriend, Vicky Jo Groves. The Indy Star reported that he told police he'd cooperate and use his criminal prowess to help solve bank robberies if they ease up on the charges for his girlfriend, Vicky. He was 39 years old at the time, and they sentenced him to 28 years in federal prison. But MLJ would never go quietly. Just 6 years into his sentence, he would make a fourth attempt to break out of prison, this time with five other inmates. On October 22, 1983, MLJ escaped the U.S. Penitentiary in Lompoc, California, by ramming a prison garbage truck through the fence. He and his counterparts only made it a short distance before losing control of the truck when faced with gunfire from the guard towers and a roadblock. One inmate died in the crash, while MLJ and the other inmates were taken back to the prison. He would remain in custody for 22 years before being paroled in 2005, long enough to celebrate his 68th birthday before violating his parole just 8 months later. MLJ's paper trail ends in 2019 when Will Higgins of the Indy Star writes a few profiles on him before his final release from prison. By the summer of 2022, I was frantically searching for MLJ, hoping for any sign that he might be alive at 84 years old. With the help of several dedicated interns and researchers at the MDJ, we called countless phone numbers, following up on the coldest leads, anything we could to get one step closer. We searched for distant relatives, old associates, even former lawmen, but everything turned up empty. Leon Johnson would prove to be a literal dead end. He died in 1999, just 4 years after his daughter, Leah Johnson, petitioned the court for his release in 1995. After weeks of searching, we had nearly given up hope when someone picked up on the other line.
Tell me your full name.
Leah Marie Johnson.
And who are you?
Leon Johnson's daughter.
And who is Leon Johnson a brother of?
Morslyn Johnson.
When I first spoke to Leah during that initial phone call in 2022, she burst into tears, telling me she had been waiting years for me to call. We were both in shock on the phone that we were talking to each other, searching for each other without knowing it. I asked if she'd be open to giving an interview, that I'd travel wherever she was to hear her story. She asked if I'd ever made my way up to Indianapolis. As fate would have it, I was driving there the next weekend for a friend's wedding. Sitting across the table from Leah in a rest stop in Cloverdale, just outside of Indy, it was like swapping stories with my own family member. One moment, she would laugh about her grandchildren, saying I reminded her of them, sharing pictures of her Cheweenie dog. The next, she would show me the lead pipe in her car she kept, just in case anyone wanted to try her. Her male companion was a character in his own right, a former outlaw who liked sharing stories about the mountain law his grandfather kept in the deep woods of Appalachia and his tales from the joint. Her perspective on her father, Leon Johnson, and her uncle, MLJ, brought these characters to life. She said her father was a mean man who talked with a speech impediment but adored her immensely. Her uncle was indeed the charming con and the ladies' man we've heard about. Leah's story contains accounts of violence, trauma, and abuse. Please take care while listening.
What was your dad like growing up? You said that he was the mean one, but what was he like to you, you know, as a father?
The time I got to be with my dad is the best thing I ever had. You know, he was my hero. He was everything.
Leah Johnson's childhood wasn't just unconventional. It was shaped by crime, constant movement, and survival. But what stays with her most is the memory of her father.
I learned to read and write from prison. All of our letters came from, you know, we only know how to write in code. It's really hard to read or writing. Even people who've known us for 20 years that's read my letters, you know. Dad always protected his children.
But protection didn't always look like love. Sometimes it looked like fear. Leah told me a story from her early years while her family was on the run from the FBI.
One time when we was on the run from the FBI, Dad had us three kids in Florida, and it had to have been before he went to prison. It had to have been in the late 60s, early 70s. Well, my mom, the lady that had me, she was out on the beach and locked us kids in the house. And Dad came home from work, and he had his work boots on, and he called her out there on the beach with Nick, my stepdad, the one that she ended up marrying. And Dad drug her in the house, and he took and beat her so bad that night that there was blood smeared all through the whole house. And he took the iron poker, and I remember the bathroom, the toilet bowl was busted open where he cracked her upside her head. And blood was smeared all through the house, and his kids were locked in the bedroom. And her head looked like a basketball sitting on it when he let us out of the room. And I guess I thought he beat her with the iron poker, but a friend of mine told me that he beat her with his boots on and was kicking her and beating her with the boots. And she was almost dead, so he took her to the convenience store and propped her body up. He propped her body up there so the construction workers would find her the next day and just, you know, find out who she was. Well, he went back the next day and she was still alive. Well, I remember the FBI and my Uncle Reed and them coming and getting us kids. And the FBI showed up and Dad had to run and he had to leave us. And then Florida went and treated her. They lifelined her back to Indiana. And then the FBI got us up to my Uncle Reed. That was one of the, you know, and there's many, many stories of things like that.
That kind of violence wasn't rare. Leah's story is filled with moments like that. And her memories of family, especially her Uncle Morris, are just as intense.
What can you tell me about your Uncle Morris?
Oh, well, I remember the time when he escaped from prison in 75, Dad was home. And so my brother and my dad and I drove down to meet Morris. And I remember being a kid and them guys, I guess they went out and robbed a bank or something. And while me and my brother, Frankie, stayed at home, Dad was with Candy, his girlfriend, and Morris had Laura Kay with him. And they came back. And of course, his kids weren't allowed in that back room, but we did sneak in there, and we did see some Tommy guns and a whole bunch of guns that we weren't allowed to be in. Well, later that night, they came in, and I guess they must have got a bank or something because we all had to sit in a circle. And as we were sitting in the circle, we were separating all the money and putting it in piles, and my hands turned black, and I couldn't believe how black they went. So anyways, they end up putting it all in them little brown paper lunch bags, and we put it all in the brown paper lunch bags, the 20s, the 100s, and whatever they separated. And Dad, and the next day we all were at, and my dad allowed me to do what I wanted. Well, Morris told Dad that I needed my hind end whooped, and Dad told him to try to take and get me down and do it. Well, Morris tried for about 4 or 5 minutes, and he finally managed to get me down. After I squirmed like a snake, and he went to go whoop me, and my dad took and pulled the gun out and told him he'd blow his brains out if he touched me. Morris and him, they weren't very happy over that deal, and of course I didn't get my butt whooped. Well, later that night, they all went out, you know, to have cocktails and drinks, and eat dinner and stuff. And Dad came home, and him and Morse got in a fight. Dad kept calling his girlfriend a poodle because she got a perm put in her hair. And Morse didn't like that because Morse was a ladies' man. He was very respectful and a charmer. You know, they all loved Morse. But my dad, he couldn't talk well. So, you know, Dad didn't, he was the mean one. And so Dad and Morse, they end up in the parking lot with the guns out, and Morse pistol whooped Dad pretty good. So the old man came home, back to the place where me and my brother were staying when Morse was on run. And Dad told us to get our stuff and get in the car. We was going back to Indiana. And as we was doing that, Frankie Rance, the wheel man of Dad and Morse, he was with us down there that time. Frankie Kicken came to check on Dad, and when he came to check on Dad, he stood at the bottom step because he knew what he was going to happen. And Dad opened the door with a knife to gut him, you know, thinking it was Morse and it was Frankie, and he let Frankie know we was leaving, that Morse was on his own. He could take care of it, and he wasn't doing nothing else for him. And we got in the Cadillac, and we drove back to Indy. And then I guess Dad and, or Morse and Larkay and them guys, they packed up. And, of course, we had to, you know, you had to keep moving. You can't stay in one location when you got FBI and DEA and all them on you. So they got up and headed out as well.
Leah and her siblings lived in chaos. Every time someone came home with a haul of money, it wasn't a celebration. It was survival.
What was it like when they would come back home from a heist with all that money?
Really chaos, kind of scary, you know, which they are hiding spots and stuff, you know, like you'd run to one house, you know, to see how hot the cops were. You'd hang out there for an hour, then you'd leave that spot and go to your safe spot, you know, or you'd have one that would take and keep the cops on that one, you know, while the other one went to the safe house, you know, and wait in that house until that one returned, and then you guys both go to safe, you know, safe house. So it's always kind of things like that.
So it sounds like there's a lot of planning involved, obviously, when you're robbing a bank or you're burglarizing a bank. So can you walk me through the steps of how they would plan to do it? Or, you know, you're talking about safe houses. Did they make all those plans beforehand?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I didn't get to know because I was so young, you know, but, you know, watching and their actions and different things that we did and, you know, driving around in the car and looking at things and renting places and, you know, yeah, that's how it went. And like Frankie Rance was the wheel driver, you know, he would be the one in one car and then there'd be other cars lined up, you know, they'd get away in that car, then they'd go to the other car and, you know, ditch that car and things like that.
Tell me about the time that your father escaped from prison.
Dad came out, Leavenworth, Kansas. It was a laundry truck. And he made him a little spot in where they welded barrels of the laundry out to the truck to get washed and bring back. And he had a little cubby hole cut out in there where he hid inside of that. And he got out and he made it and he escaped. And that's when he hooked up with me. I was living in Cloverleaf and I was probably 12 years old, maybe 11, and my brother was always with him. My brother and Laura Kay's son always was with them guys on anything. Almost everything, there was always a minor in the events, and that was my brother and my cousin. Anyways, the FBI, Frankie came and told me that, you know, Dad was down the road and I could go see him, so I finally got to go see Dad at the motel and talked to him for a few minutes while the FBI seen us and knew it. And Dad had to get out of there. So my brother jumped in the pickup truck. I took him left walking back to the apartment, even though as little as I was. Went back to the apartment, and they surrounded the Cloverleaf apartments, helicopters, FBI, the whole woods, dogs, everywhere, all over. Frankie took off in the pickup truck, and the FBI men jumped on the pickup truck, and Frankie drug him down Washington Street, and what was that one cop's name? I'll think of it. But he came to the house personally and he told me, he said, I'll tell you what, little girl, I'm going to put you in prison. He said, and I'll make sure when I get your brother, I don't care how young he is, I'm going to put him in prison too. Both of you guys are going to go back, you're going to go to prison. And that's another thing I remember when Dad was on escape. Him and Sherman Lane, God rest her soul too, and my brother Frankie, they were in an apartment. Dad ran from there, I guess, in 75. They were in an apartment, and the whole place was surrounded with SWAT team and FBI. And they had my brother, and they had Sherman Lane, and the other one that I told you, that my cousin. They were in an apartment. Well, that Sherman Lane was pregnant, and they had her up in there, and they had them all up against the wall, and walks right down the street, right in front of every one of them cops, and walks by and looks up at the apartment and lets them know, you know, because they seen him, and they knew he got away. So they all surrendered and went ahead and went with the cops, and of course they couldn't do nothing to the minors, and Sherman Lane, she was pregnant, and Dad wasn't there, you know, so... And then one time when they were doing that one, too, I remember just now, Dad was telling me how he had, he said, it was in the time when he was at the motel. He said, baby, he said, I was running. He said, and there was an 8-foot fence, and I had a whole field of cops following me, running and behind me. He said, and I had them two gunny bags of money. He said, and I climbed that big old 8-foot fence and jumped over that fence. He said, and that fence hooked that bag of money. And that money just went flying all back to all them cops, he said, and I just kept on going.
Frankie, Leah's brother, was always by their father's side, but he carried scars of his own.
Frankie had a lot of demons he had to deal with. Our mother was a bad drug addict. And she used to give us a lot of medicine and Piragoric and stuff like that, keep us quiet. And he always got all of her pills. And, of course, we were alcoholics running Johnson's family. And we were all alcoholics before we were 12 years old. And Frankie dealt a lot with... he was raped, that I just found out, by my stepdad after my real mom died. My stepdad raped all of us. And she's still with him. And I have a baby that was his that I had to give up for adoption. He's probably 43 now, 44, that we don't know where he's at. And he's still alive, my stepdad. So Frankie went through a lot of abuse, you know. And, of course, he lived on the streets like my grandson. And when you live on the streets and you have no family, you're pretty much an orphan. You just survive and learn, and I learned from different families and people that took me in what you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to act and what families do together and things like that, so.
The crimes may have brought money, but not security, and certainly not peace.
Do you have any idea how much money that your uncle and your father may have stolen over the course of their careers?
Their story always was, you never made enough money because you had to pay everyone you went to. Everywhere you went, you had to pay someone. So, you know, and back then, $100, you know, that was a lot of money. And then it went up to 500 and thousands, you know, just to be able to know that you drove through that neighborhood and they're not going to call the cops and say, hey, we seen Leon Johnson or we seen Morris Johnson. So they never made it enough. Oh, and you can see we don't have nothing to show for the money. It all, money goes as fast as it comes, and money means nothing.
It's at this point in our interview that Leah's ghosts, as she likes to call them, try to mess with our audio recording.
They want me to shut up because I got powerful ghosts.
No.
No, I'm saying my ghosts are powerful. They may shut everything down. They will.
I know, your dad's from the grave, so don't be talking about him.
What are some of the ways that you helped your family around the time? Because you have these memories as a kid where, you know, you're counting money for your dad and things like that. Can you recall any other memories where you're helping your dad out with his heists and things like that?
Us kids really were never allowed in any of that. And then especially in outlaw life, a woman is never allowed to know anything or be a part of it. They are black. We call it Blackwell. And my brother did more of the stuff with dad, you know, or if there was a stakeout or any, you know, I was pretty well protected and them things like that. I wasn't allowed to know. When dad came home in 95, now I did all of our criminal cases. If robberies came up, anything with law, I did all them cases. I had to do all of our license plates. We had 7. I had to do all the banking. I had to do all the running. You did things you did not ask. You just take a package, you drop it off, you do what you're told, you know. But they never really put me, because of my kids, they kept me kind of out, but I was still there.
What Leah carries isn't just her family's legacy of crime. It's the love, loss, and pain that comes with it, and the determination to tell the story in her own voice.
Take it to the bank, like we always said, you can take that to the bank.
Yeah.
And cash it, because it will cash. That was one of their favorite sayings. You can take that to the bank.
Take that to the
bank. Yeah. Yep. Dad, there was another story. Dad in 75, when he came home from prison, he wanted to buy that three apartments. And he went into the bank to borrow $32,000. They wouldn't give it to him. So the next day, he went in and robbed the damn bank and got the 30. He only borrowed 32,000. Only took 32,000.
Took exactly what he was looking for. Yeah. What year was that?
In 75. And we bought the three apartments, and that's when we went to Florida and seen Morse on the run.
That's hilarious. The fact that he was like, you're not going to give me the money, I'm going to
take it. And he did. He went in there and he told him he was robbing him and he needed $32,000. And that's what he got.
Well, you know, when I was reading about your uncle, because, like, there's more stuff online, and how he had sent FBI agents postcards at Christmas time.
Yeah, I was driving, because Morris went to see my mom when he escaped, and he took her a briefcase of money in Ohio, because I remember this man coming in a business suit, because Morris was always preppy, you know, slick cars, slick money, everything, you know, best clothes. But I remember this man coming up, and he must have been with Laura Kay, to her house, because those kids was always flying, you know, they always tried to keep us away or doped up. And I remember him coming, and then the next thing I know, we're leaving our house in Ohio and coming back to Indiana, and then I heard on the radio, well, Morse, we got your Christmas card that you sent us, but you forgot to leave us a return address. And I remember running up to the front of the van and telling Patty, my real mom, I'm like, ain't that my uncle? And she's like, just don't worry about it, just go back there. And I'm like, and you know, and I'm thinking, he sent them Christmas cards.
What do you want the world to know about the Johnson family?
They were good people, really. They had hearts. We worked hard. We've changed, we tried for generations and generations to take and clear our name. You know, it wasn't supposed to be like that, but it ended up being that way. You know, and we've got family, and, you know, we wanted to be respectable people, you know, and live right.
What do you want for your family today?
Them just to be happy. Have God and raise their babies, and then babies be able to, they know about their grandpa, you know, a little bit and stuff, but, you know, that's stuff that they have to do when they're older and they want to research it, you know. Right now, they need to just be kids and not even know that part of life, you know. so that they can have their life and not be judged like we were and watched everywhere you go and things like that.
I think that's all any of us can really hope for our families. To walk through life knowing they're loved, to shirk the pain and the shame from generations past, and head confidently towards the future. I have found Morris Lynn Johnson's family, but where was he? Coming up on the final episode of Robbery, Inc., we finally know the whereabouts of Morris Lynn Johnson. We'll explore the legacy of his family and why America has seen the last of its notorious bank robbers.
A task force of federal, state, and local officers arrested 68-year-old Morris Johnson at a motel near the Indianapolis International Airport Thursday as he tried to buy several automatic and semi-automatic weapons.
Robbery, Inc. is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting and the Marietta Daily Journal. Robbery, Inc. is written and hosted by Madison Elizabeth Hogan. I'm on Instagram at Madison Elizabeth Hogan. This podcast was produced and edited by GPB's podcast team of Jeremy Powell, Jake Cook, and Mark Davenport. Special thanks to Olivia Watkin, Jaden Henson, and Rachel Kellogg.